And good morning to all of you for being here with us to listen to the Beatles, talking about the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album. That song, Good Morning, Good Morning, one of the tunes on that album, landmark album with cultural and musical effects. A lot of folks would say, you know, they hear the effects and the animal sounds on that. They say, ah, that it's just studio magic. It's George Martin producing it. It's not even the Beatles on these instruments, complaints like that. When we come back, we're going to ask Bruce Spicer his take on the role of the Beatles themselves and hands-on production of that album, what it did to the music industry, and what's coming next on the 50th anniversary. Stick around. Bruce Spicer, a lot of stuff in the book I had never heard before, never read. Among them, the point you make about Pink Floyd. I guess they were in the studio at the same time?
Yeah. Here they are doing Piper at the Gates of Dawn at Abbey Road Studio, same time as the Beatles are finishing up Sgt. Pepper. So, and of course, later on, they came out with what I guess we'd have to call their Sgt. Pepper with Dark Side of the Moon.
You've heard this this complaint from people. Well, it was just George Martin's mastery in the studio. There's trickery. There's special effects. It's not the Beatles themselves. What do you say about that?
Well, you know, first of all, it's kind of interesting you say that. When the album came out, Time Magazine's review of it was called Mix Master to the Beatles, and it started out, George Martin's new album came out last week.
Right.
And
right.
It kind of ignored the contributions of John Paul, the other George, and Ringo. But look, there is no doubt that George Martin helped the Beatles get the sounds that they were trying to achieve. The Abbey Road engineers were incredible and help the Beatles get the sounds they were trying to achieve. But it wasn't a case of like, you know, George Martin coming in and saying, okay, we're going to do this effect and that effect. It was more a case of the Beatles saying, look, we'd like to do this. Can you do it? And George Martin and the Abbey Road engineers would make it happen. So there were times when George Martin made musical suggestions, but it really was a team effort, and this wasn't a case of, you know, what you might have today where a pop diva might go into the studio and the producer comes in and says, okay, these are the 12 songs that you're going to do. They were written by great songwriters, and these are the arrangements we're going to do for you, and just basically come to the mic, sing it. We have a pitch modulator, so if you're off key, don't worry, it'll sound great. I mean, it wasn't that at all. You know, these were guys that were great rock and roll musicians, and George Martin helped them get the sounds that they had in their heads. John would say, okay, well, for the benefit of Mr. Kite, I want it to be like a circus. I want people to, you know, smell the sawdust of the big tent. I want this whirling type sound. So George Martin would say, okay, well, I can play harmonium. We can get some, you know, organ type sounds. We can cut up tapes. We can do this. And so it was really a collaboration of it. And, you know, as I said earlier in the broadcast, this wasn't art for art's sake. It was a great listening experience.
You know, you could imagine how musical history could have been different if there had been a producer other than George Martin that worked with him.
Yeah. As I point out when I give talks on the Beatles, that the luckiest day in the world for the Beatles and their greatest failure happened on January 1, 1962, when they failed the Decca audition. If Mike Smith had been producing the Beatles rather than George Martin, you know, the Beatles' first single might have been Love of the Love back with Red Sails of the Sunset, and we might have been listening to Bobby V throughout the 60s. So thank goodness that George Martin was at the production helm.
You mentioned in your book that George Martin had to deliver some tough news to George Harrison at one point about a song that was going to be on the album or wasn't going to be on the album.
Yeah, George had put forth his contribution to the album, a song called Only a Northern Song. And the group went through it, and George Martin just felt it wasn't strong enough. And he's right. And the Beatles said, well, okay, well, it's not good enough for Pepper. But shortly after Pepper, they had to come up with a couple of original tunes for a cartoon version of Yellow Submarine, which they really didn't take seriously. When it came out, it was like, wow, this is really good. But George Martin had to sit down and tell George, look, this song really isn't, you know, up to the standards that we need for this album. And so he came up with Within You, Without You. And at first, you know, when George is showing him it on acoustic guitar and with these heavy lyrics, I don't know if George Martin was overly impressed, but as George said, look, what I have in mind is we're going to bring in these Indian instruments And we're going to have this. And when he realized what George was trying to achieve, he got very excited about it. And so, these musicians came in and they recorded the Indian backing for it. And then George Martin brought in some, string instruments to be kind of a counterpoint to it. And it ends up being the most controversial track on the album among fans. You either love it or hate it. And some people who didn't get it then still don't get it. And the fan recollections, a couple of people, including Mark Lewisohn, basically said, "Look, I'm glad it started side two because I could skip it entirely and place the needle at the beginning of When I'm 64 and not have to listen to it." So.
Of course, we haven't really touched on this, but it changed so much in the music industry. I mean, the idea, as you write in the book, it before this album, it was the emphasis was on singles, and
Yes.
as you said earlier, afterward, the record companies realized, hey, we can sell albums and make more money,
Absolutely.
as well as having printing the lyrics. That had never happened before.
No, and here we are. I mean, maybe with operas it had happened, with librettos as they called them, but not for pop or rock albums. And then the Beatles and their next album, the White Album, carried on the tradition, and a lot of other groups went ahead and started printing the lyrics. And one of the other interesting fan recollections in the book was that I had this Buddy Pierce up in Canada, and he's with a friend, and they go to a record store and buy the album, and they take it back to this, house they're staying at for a couple of weeks while they're going up to the expo, and there's no record player in the house, so all they could do was look at the album cover, try to figure out who's on it, and read the lyrics to the songs on the back. But they were blown away by that and didn't even get to hear the album for a while.
So the phone lines are full, and we'll go to them in just a second. Talk
Sure.
to me about the 50th anniversary, what you're looking forward to, what you expect to happen. I ask it in this context. They just started last week a Beatles channel on Sirius XM. A, why did it take so long? And B, is it related to the album coming out, the anniversary issue coming out?
Well, I think, the Beatles have been a little bit cautious in jumping into new things. They were late on CD, they were late on downloads, they were late on streaming. But I think their philosophy in Apple is, look, we want to take the time to do it right. So, we could have done this a while back, but we want to give it some thought. And they put a lot of effort into separate projects. It's more of a, rather than doing five projects at once, Apple's philosophy seems to be, look, let's concentrate on this project and get it right, and then we'll move on to the next project and get that one the best we can make it. And it's served them well over the years. I think fans might criticize, when are they ever going to release Let It Be? Well, it'll happen eventually, and when it does, it'll be great. So, from that standpoint, I think that it was just a question of not necessarily, gee, we have to do this for Pepper, but more a case of, this is the right time to do it. We've put a lot of thought into it. As far as what to expect, there are going to be a lot of new releases. And for those who just want to say, gee, Bruce earlier talked about, Giles Martin going and remixing the stereo. Do I really need that? Yes, you do. And the reason you do is that it sounds like the mono album on steroids. In other words, this is the way that the Beatles intended the album be heard. You're going to hear instruments with a clarity you've never heard them before. You're going to hear the little touches that were on the mono album that weren't on the stereo album. A day in the life, as always, will sound like the end of the world, only more so. So, with a little help from my friends, you've got Ringo's voice coming straight down the center with the backing vocals by John, Paul, and George left and right surrounding him. It just blows me away of how everything sounds. The deluxe edition is going to be worth springing for. A bit pricey, but you can get it on Amazon for less than its retail full price. And what it does is that it has two discs of outtakes. It has a stereo remix, two discs of outtakes, which are absolutely fascinating, another disc of the original mono album with some additional early mono mixes, including an incredible mix of A Day in the Life done before Paul re-recorded his middle vocal in it, before Ringo re-recorded his drums, and Paul re-recorded his bass. So you get to hear what it would have sounded like. There also are take one and two of A Day in the Life. I mean, it's just all these wonderful things that you're going to have, and then a Blu-ray disc that has a 5.1 and a stereo, and so you hear, you know, you think stereo sounds good on CD, it's much better on Blu-ray, much better sound. In a documentary, The Making of Sgt. Pepper from 25 years ago, hosted by George Martin, absolutely fascinating. And the videos for Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields, and A Day in the Life. So, and it has a book with it. I mean, is it worth getting? Absolutely.
Yeah. Or, you know, a good companion would be your book, I think, because you go through each song, you tell what the inspiration was, who played what, how it was put together. It's the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper, a fan's perspective. It's a great read. Let's take a couple of...
I appreciate that. And if I'm allowed to do so, of course, I have a website, Beatle, BEATLE.net. So it can be ordered from that website. And I appreciate the compliment.
Absolutely. And we'll post that on the Coast to Coast website if you want to take a look at what's on there and communicate with Bruce. First-time caller, Mark in Florida. Hi, Mark. You're on with Bruce Spicer.
I am so elated that you guys took my call. I always thought maybe my first time would be with, you know, George Nori, but this is an honor, Mr. Knapp. Thank you so much. And this guy is just a Beatle genius. I'm going to make sure I have every one of his books. I, too, am turning 50 years old. I will be 50 in September. And I got all the stuff hand-me-down. I think there's something special about being a Beatle fan that you got to have, you know, you got to know the Beatles as a complete band, even at a young age. I know I missed a lot of history. You know, I know one thing. My father sat my sisters down and said, I want you to watch these guys. I think they're going to be big, when Ed Sullivan had them on there. And I just completely am floored about all this information that I'm getting. And I had a question, though. I mean, it just seems like all the best music came from the 1960s. And I still am going to say it's true. And I know, you know, I was born into that era, and I look back and I say that that's the best music in the world. But is there anything comparable? Do we ever say, we always compare people to the Beatles, oh, that's the new Lennon McCartney. I remember when the Knack came out, that's the new Beatles, maybe because they had a look. But I know this for sure, that people said something about Tears for Fears, oh, they're great composers. Do you think there's anybody that you can even say right now that is, you know, musical genius? Or what's your take on that, sir?
I think that, you know, it's a lot of people, gee, well, they're going to be the next Beatles. There just hasn't been a next Beatles. I think, you know, when you moved on to the 70s, I mean, you certainly had a lot of great artists. Certainly Elton John was doing a lot of things, or Bruce Springsteen, or, you know, Michael Jackson. So there were a lot of things, but it never was the same as the Beatles. What made them so special was that you had Lennon and McCartney as absolutely great songwriters, and then George Harrison later on blooming as a great songwriter. I think the reason that Capitol Records was willing, when it was time for a new contract, to give them such a great contract for music industry standards at the time, in, you know, 1967, 68, was because they knew that with this songwriting, it would be that way. And look, let's think, why are we talking about the Beatles, you know, 50 years on and all? Look, I may not be here in 50 years from now, but somewhere in America there will be a Coast to Coast broadcast, and they'll be talking about the Beatles again, because the truly great music, we talk about Louis Armstrong, the same reason we talk about Bach, Beethoven, Schubert, truly great songs and music is timeless, and that's what the Beatles are giving us. I think a lot of the music we get after it, you know, some of it is truly great, but I don't know if it's going to be considered timeless like the Beatles. You know, I don't want to pick on every pop diva out there, but a lot of these artists are going to be fun to watch in concert and do these outrageous videos and change their look in their hair and all these other things. But do you really think 50 years later people are going to be talking about those albums and, you know, their catalog the way that they do about the Beatles? And I just don't see it happening. The Beatles were the right group at the right time. I know it sounds cliched, but the 60s were an exciting time. And the way radio was, it wasn't fragmented like it is today. You know, you didn't have hundreds of different radio stations you could choose from for different genres of music. You had Top 40, which meant people were exposed to everything. And that meant even if you weren't a rock and roll fan, if you were listening to Top 40, you heard rock and roll music. And if you liked it, you became a Beatles fan. And I think I don't think that can happen again because of the way we listen to music and all, and the way it's delivered. So I think this is not only a once in a generation or once in a lifetime, I think it's a once in a forever.
Thanks, Mark. Is there a sales metric by which you measure how they're doing today? I mean, people don't even buy records. They think everything should be for free, right?
Well, that's the sad thing about it is you have a whole generation grown up that believes that it's okay to not pay for music. And of course, that's not, we worried about the big bad record companies. Look, these big bad record companies are putting this music out. And then you have new ways of, young struggling musicians putting it out themselves and people downloading it for free and not paying for it. It's a shame because it is going to cut down on what people can do. I'm hoping that people begin to appreciate, people listen to it more. We're back to singles. It was albums for so long, and now it's you download one song. You don't bother downloading the album because most albums, quite frankly, you don't want to download. And that, in a way, is sad. So there are these changes that are happening, but I think that the Beatles have done a good job of trying to stay relevant with the changes. Slow to jump on to streaming and downloading, but doing it right when they're doing it.
Well, they jealously guarded and protected what they have. That
Yeah.
catalog is incredibly valuable.
Absolutely.
We'll take one more call. We're going to go to a break in about 2 minutes. So, west of the Rockies, Joseph in San Diego. Hey, Joseph.
Well, let me turn my speakerphone off. Thank you for taking my call. So
Better jump right to it here. We're going to be going to a
yeah,
break
you're gonna
soon.
do this. Sorry. Yeah. A good friend of mine was very good friends with George Harrison. And he often would call me and say, not George, but my friend, would say, George is out in the garden, And that All Things Must Pass album, there were so many, didn't Bob Dylan write one of the songs for the album? And can you explain a little bit about who was on the album for All Things Must Pass, where he wrote My Sweet Lord?
Well, George had a lot of musicians that he was working with at the time, a group that later formed Derek and the Dominoes, Eric Clapton, Carl Rattle, and others. The thing about All Things Must Pass was a lot of those were songs that George had written while he was with the Beatles, such as All Things Must Pass and several other of those songs, Hear Me, Lord, and things. And the Beatles ran through them, but George would get maybe two songs or three songs an album at most because he was competing. Getting placement on the album with John Lennon and Paul McCartney. So when George did All Things Must Pass, he had an incredible group of songs that could have been Beatles songs had the group stayed together, but it might have taken him, 5 or 6 Beatles albums to get them all out. So one of the good things about the breakup, if there is such a thing, is that it enabled George to get his songs out a lot quicker, and they were excellent songs, of course.
If Not For You, is that the Bob Dylan song that I think he recorded?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks to our callers. The phones are still pretty full here. Bruce Spizer is my guest, and we'll get back to the phones in a moment. His book is called The Beatles and Sgt. Pepper, A Fan's Perspective. Among the fans who weigh in is Billy Joel, who remarks that he was in the right place at the right time, age-wise, and he calls the album a masterpiece. We're going to hear an excerpt from the album, one of the songs called Getting Better. From Sgt. Pepper and the Lonely Hearts Club Band, and we'll be back with my guest Bruce Spizer in just a moment. A Day in the Life, the final song on Sgt. Pepper's, the grand finale, that final note, sort of unforgettable, and the song kind of showcasing all that the Beatles could do. We're talking with Bruce Spizer about his book, The Beatles and Sgt. Pepper, A Fan's Perspective. The fans are speaking. The phone lines are full. We'll get to as many as we can right after this. Bruce, one last question before we go back to the phones. Dealing with Lennon versus McCartney during the feud years, John Lennon made some pretty disparaging remarks about this album, Sgt. Pepper's, mainly to try to hurt McCartney, I think. The perception being that it was McCartney's project or that he was the driving force there. Was that just a moment for John Lennon? I mean, certainly they all contributed. McCartney had the idea for the band, the persona, but it was all of them contributing to this.
Clearly, and look, John at a time went through a period where he trashed everything, including himself, where, you know, gee, you know, I wish we had done these songs better, like Strawberry Fields Forever. I mean, come on, Strawberry Fields is great. But look, this was, in many ways, Paul's show, in that Paul has incredible melodic bass lines on the album. He has great keyboards. You listen to A Day in the Life, John's song, and Paul's little middle section has this great little jazzy piano riff going in the background. Paul played some incredible lead guitar on the album, on the title track, and things of that, and contributed these great songs. But look, George had some great moments as well on guitar. He also contributed with In You Without You, which was an incredible song at the time and still very cool to listen to. Ringo's drumming throughout is incredible. And although John didn't have as many songs as Paul, he contributed to Paul's songs, such as, you know, Getting Better, coming out with the counterpoint, He Couldn't Get No Worse, or, you know, his wonderful counterpoint on She's Leaving Home, and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, just an incredible song. A Day in the Life, clearly the top song on the album, you know, and when it was reviewed by the New York Times, although the Richard Goldstein trashed the album, he called A Day in the Life an historic pop event. So, you know, while Paul certainly, you know, in many ways, it's Paul's showcase, don't underestimate the contributions of all of the Beatles on this album.
East of the Rockies, Robert in New York City. Hi, Robert. You're on with Bruce Spicer.
Hi, good morning. Thanks, George, for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, thanks.
Bruce, thank you so much. You're bringing back a flood of memories. You're talking about vinyl, needles, turntables. It's fantastic. I would like to tell you a really interesting story. Are you ready?
Yes.
So back in 1972, I was 22. I was in London. One of the things I wanted to do is go see Apple Records. And it's 3 Savile Row, a big white building. And it was the day after Christmas. It was Boxing Day. I must tell you, I don't look the same now as I did back in 72. There was a police officer in front of the building. I said, I walked up, and the cop said to me, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm with the band." The fellow said, "Go right in."
I thought that line, "I'm with the band," only worked with attractive women.
I'm not an attractive woman, but it was the first thing that came to my head. I said, "I'm with the band." I didn't lean heavy on them. I'm from New York, you know. I get to go where I want to go. I walked in. The place was trashed. The Christmas tree was upside down. There was boxes. There was papers. There was stuff laying around. And I'm thinking to myself, I actually did this. I'm in the studio, Apple Records, where the Beatles are recording and doing stuff and socializing. I said, "Man, I better get the hell out of here quick." So I walked down this hallway, and I must tell you, there was a bit of larceny in my heart when I was there. And I see Ringo Starr's drum kit all packaged up, ready to go. And I said to myself, "I need to take a souvenir. I don't want a coffee mug. I need to take something important." So I walked over to Ringo Starr's drum kit. On his bass drum, there's like a flap, kind of a pocket with a snap. I reached in there, and I found Ringo Starr's drumsticks, put them in my pocket. I left quickly. I said to the cop outside, "Thank you very much." I went back to the youth hostel I was staying at, and to this very day, I have Ringo Starr's drumsticks in a Ziploc.
So if the police are looking for you, do you want to leave your address? Or
No. There was Zildjian. And they may have his DNA on them. And Ringo, if you're listening, if you're missing 2 drumsticks back in 1972, I got them.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you. Thanks for sharing the story there, Robert. I had imagined in 1972, would Ringo's drum kits have still been there, Bruce?
Well, it's possible that they would have at Apple. And they had a studio down in the basement there that the Beatles weren't so much recording in, but other artists were. So it's certainly possible that he Could have been hanging around there, you know.
On the wild card line, Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Good morning, Frank.
Howdy, guys. Glad to be back with you. Bruce, I got a couple of questions for you, but I want to make a comment. My favorite Beatles song right now is Taxman, which George did a good job. That song is well written. And the question I have for you is, on the Sgt. Pepper album, all the deceased celebrities there, did they have to get a special copyright, a special permission to put them on the album at that time? What were the copyright laws at that time? And my second question is, why McCartney, Lennon and McCartney, songwriting team, how come the first name, Lennon, calls all the shots? I mean, like Yoko, when Yoko inherited his estate, there was one song that she wouldn't let Paul record. What is that all about?
Well, let's start with the what was the first question, real quick?
It's about the album, the faces on the album. Thanks, Frank, calling in.
That's a great question. EMI was terrified about this, that they would be sued, and they made the Beatles take out an indemnity clause insurance policy up to, you know, to millions of pounds in the events they were sued. But what the Beatles did was they got permission. They wrote letters to the people that were alive to see if it was okay to use their image on it. And everybody, for the most part, said fine. There was one kid, Leo Dorsey, who was with the Dead End Kids, and he wanted money for the use of it. And they said thanks, but no thanks. And they took his image off the cover. He would have been included, but for that. Mae West was approached with it, and she wrote back a letter saying, why would I want to be associated with a Lonely Hearts Club band? And so the group took the time to write her a follow-up letter explaining what they were doing, and she agreed. So she's on the cover. Shirley Temple's actually on the cover three times as a young child actress, as a more older woman, and also there's a Shirley Temple doll. So she's on the cover three times. A great trivia question. And almost everyone on that cover today is dead. Bob Dylan is still with us, but most of the people on that cover are now deceased, and several were deceased at the time that the album cover came out 50 years ago. As for Lennon McCartney, John just always felt Lennon McCartney sounded better than McCartney Lennon. Of course, Paul thought McCartney Lennon sounded better, but John was the leader of the group, and Paul gave in on that, although on some of the earlier records, particularly the Please Please Me album, the songs are listed as McCartney Lennon, and there's been a little bickering over the years as far as, you know, can they be changed? And there have been instances on Paul's albums where he might list it as McCartney Lennon, but no matter how you slice it, these guys were a great songwriting team. They both contributed. They brought out the best of each other.
Bruce, I wanted to mention that I enjoyed not only reading the book, but some of the graphics are nice touches. The poster that inspired John Lennon to write the Mr. Kite song, you have a reproduction of that. You have a reproduction of the note, the artwork that the Beatles sent to Monterey Pop, the festival. They were invited to perform there, and they sent a really cool a graphic piece that said thanks but no thanks, and we wish you kind of luck. That's a nice touch.
It was fun putting the images together. A lot of things from my collection, such as the album and then the newspaper covers and articles and things of that nature. And I did license, of course, some photographs, a lot of from the Beatles book. And the other fun thing was in the fan recollection section, I asked people to send in pictures that they may have had with the album cover. And think about it, 50 years ago, we did not have cameras on our cell phones. Wait a minute, we didn't even have cell phones. So if we wanted to take pictures, we had to use a camera, we had to pay for the film, and we had to have it developed. So you didn't have a ton of pictures back then like you do today, or selfies and all this. But we got some wonderfully cute pictures of people holding the album cover, a girl clutching it at Christmas time, a little kid on his bicycle holding the album cover gatefold in the family photo taken in their backyard. Mark Lewis and the Beatles author, where he was at the time 8 or 9, he cut out the badges and put them on his shirt. The sergeant stripes were on his sleeves, and he had the fake mustache under his nose. You know, just wonderful
Yeah, Billy Joel's band. Billy Joel's band.
The Hassles. And he's all hiding in the back on keyboard. So, you know, it was a lot of fun putting the images together. I think that, you know, Pepper was both a visual and musical experience, and I wanted to make the book, like all my books, you know, a visual treat as well as, you know, information in the words.
Well, you did. We'll go to Mark in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hi, Mark. You're on with Bruce.
Hello, guys.
Howdy.
Excellent. You know, I had an original question, but I'll just make a statement on that. I bought that set that came out quite some time ago, where and it shows perfectly how the Beatles really did and George Martin focus on the mono mixes, which you brought up a couple of times. I'm looking forward to getting that new package with the stereo you speak of. But there is such a difference in those mono mixes, especially on the Pepper album. That being said, I believe, too, that what happened during that period when the Beatles quit touring and everything, and I want to refer also, like you said, back in those days, we didn't have mass media throwing everything at you and anything like that, you know? And so by the Beatles not being in a public, you know, way and under the spotlight every second for that period of time, which seemed to be a long, long time, it set up a mystique also as well, you know, I believe, you know, because no one knows what they're doing or anything else like that.
Hey, Mark, I'm gonna let Bruce respond to that. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Bruce, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was this great anticipation building in this mystique. And one of the tracks kind of snuck out early, an Acetate of a Day in the Life, which got some airplay in major cities, not just in the United States, but also in Canada and other. And so the anticipation for the entire album was high. Radio London got a copy of the album on tape format and was playing it a few weeks in advance, which forced EMI to release it. Although its official release date was June 1, it actually was in stores a week earlier. In the U.S., the album in Los Angeles, a disc jockey, Dave Hall, had a copy from the Capitol pressing plant. He was playing for a few days, and two, Capitol protested. The station fired him, and of course rehired him because he was a very popular disc jockey. But the anticipation was absolutely incredible. Stations were saying, we're going to start playing the album at a particular time, but they were allowed to. One kid in his fan recollection knew it could be played after midnight, so he stayed up that night in bed with his transistor radio, switching stations, because no station would play the entire album. They'd play a track or two from it, changing the band to try to hear those songs. So there was tremendous anticipation for this album, and yet other people didn't know it was coming out. And some fan recollections, I was driving in my car and heard these songs. Barry Winslow is with the Royal Guardsmen. They were going to a session to record Snoopy's Christmas, because you have to do Christmas songs in the summer to have them ready. And here he is hearing a song from Sgt. Pepper and pulls off to listen to it. Can you imagine, you know, just think of that. You're about to record Snoopy's Christmas and you're hearing Sgt. Pepper.
All right, we go to Carlos in Hawaii. We'll try to get one more call in here. Hey, Carlos, how you doing?
Aloha, George. Hello, Bruce.
Thank you.
I had the opportunity to know the Beatles, to have met them, and I know for a fact that there were some secret recording sessions, and I know that their plan was to put out songs that were newly recorded and say that they were remixed. So I think we're going to run into that. You may hear on one of the songs, you may hear Ringo say he'd like to thank the Zippers for allowing them the opportunity to open for the Zippers. But that's not what I called about. What I called about is that we're still seeing the same cover stories that we saw back when we were kids. I'm 69 years old. And the stories are still the party line. The same stories. We're not getting any insight into who these people really are, who they really were. And in some cases, the musicians, the Beatles, they had other names, other identities they used with other groups that they played with. And we're not seeing any of the consolidation of personas from the artists from back in the 1960s.
All right, Carlos, I'm going to have to interrupt you. You've given us a lot to chew on there. You ever heard this about the Zippers, Bruce?
I have to zip up on that one. I say no. But I will say, look, the thing about it was that we are learning more and more about the Beatles. Mark Lewisohn is doing a 3-part series on them, and part one came out, and we learned all kind of new things, and we'll be learning new things about the Beatles through his books, and there are new things to be learned. One of the things that people are saying that's really cool about this book is we finally learn, you know, who the inspiration for the picture of Sergeant Pepper on the cutout card was.
Oh, yeah.
It was James Melville Babington, who was a British military. He was a major general, lieutenant general, the whole bit. And so, there are still new things about the Beatles being learned 50 years on. And 50 years on, we'll get to hear Pepper the way that the Beatles would have had us hear Pepper had the technology been there. So, you know, for people to say, gee, I'm not going to get this, I'll just keep listening to the mono. You know, all those little touches that are in the mono are on this stereo remix. So you do need to get the stereo remix.
You had said after 8 Beatle books, you were done, and now you've got this one. Are you done?
I don't want to be like The Who and going on my farewell tour again. if I find a project that's worthy of doing, I'll do it. For me, the 50th anniversary of Pepper was worthy of doing, so I did the book.
Well, Bruce Spicer, thanks very much for being here and staying up late. I hope you don't have too many clients coming into the law office in the morning.
No, I don't, but I do have a few things going on, and it was a blast doing it. And one last plug, the website's beatle.net.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks, folks. Check it out, The Beatles and Sergeant Pepper, A Fan's Perspective. It's a lot of fun. As a book, I want to thank Bruce Spicer, also Jeremy Corbell for being here earlier, and my crew, our crew at Coast to Coast, Nathan Staten and Donna Walker, our webmaster tonight, Lex Lonehood, Dan Galani and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp, and I'll be back next Sunday. Good night, everyone.